Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are putting on our critical care hats, really diving into a topic that defines high-stakes medicine, chest trauma. We're talking about that intersection, you know, where rapid assessment meets life-or-death decisions. This isn't just theory for you listening.
Oh.
These are the immediate, life-saving moves that can make all the difference in the trauma bay.
That's exactly right. And for everyone listening, especially, you know, if you're in training, maybe nursing students or clinicians already working in high acuity settings, our goal today, our mission is to kind of move beyond just the textbook checklist.
Right.
We really want to distill the advanced clinical knowledge that's essential nuances about assessment, the latest in management surgical principles, and really mastering procedures like chest tube care. We want you to walk away feeling not just informed, but clinically sharp. Prepared.
Yeah, because the really scary thing about thoracic injuries is how sneaky they can be.
Deceptive, yeah.
Right. A seemingly minor external injury, maybe just some bruising, can hide catastrophic damage inside. You've got the heart, the great vessels right there in the chest cavity.
Yeah.
So the risk of massive, rapid internal bleeding, what we call exsanguination, it's always there, lurking.
Constantly. And if you're not ready to jump in immediately, the patient can deteriorate. They can crash in just seconds.
Okay, let's break down that immediate emergency foundation.
Yeah.
We always, always start with the mantra, ABCs. Mm. Airway, breathing, circulation. Now, this sequence, it isn't just tradition, is it? It's driven by physiology. Why, specifically in trauma, is this order non-negotiable?
Well, it really dictates the priority based on what's going to kill the patient the fastest. Simple as that. An obstructed airway, that's the quickest killer.
Right.
If you don't secure the airway first, frankly, anything else you do for breathing or circulation is, well, it's pointless.
Makes sense.
Once that airway is clear, then you assess breathing. Are they actually exchanging oxygen? Is the chest rising and falling effectively? And finally, circulation, are they perfusing? Is that oxygenated blood getting around? And in severe trauma, that C often means stopping massive bleeding, right? Hemorrhage control.
Absolutely. And when we talk about supporting circulation, the sources really hammer home the immediate needs. High flow oxygen, obviously, but also vascular access. Let's talk specifics here.
Yeah.
At least two large bore IVs, preferably 18 gauge or higher. Why is that size so critical?
We absolutely need two lines, minimum. Yeah. And the gauge, the size, it matters hugely. We're not just aiming for a slow drip here. We need flow rate.
Right, like a fire hose.
Pretty much. If the patient is bleeding out, exsanguinating, we need to pour in crystalloid fluids initially, sure. But more importantly, we need to be ready to give blood products, packed red cells, plasma, platelets, massive volumes, and fast. A standard little 22-gauge free IV just can't handle the thickness, the viscosity of blood, or the sheer volume needed to save someone who's profoundly hypotensive. An 18-gauge, or ideally a 16-gauge, that allows for genuine, rapid resuscitation.
Okay, so everyone learns the too large bores rule. Yeah. But let's get practical, especially for our nursing students listening. You're in a code situation, the patient's crashing, they're shocked, veins are clamped down, peripheral access is tough.
Our protocol shifting. Is it better to go for immediate intraosseous IO access instead of struggling for those two difficult peripherals? Can an IO even handle blood products effectively?
Oh, that's a fantastic, really critical clinical question. And the answer is yes, absolutely. Time is tissue, time is life.
Right.
The standard now is often. If you can't get peripheral access within, say, two attempts or about 90 seconds in a crashing patient, you move immediately to IO, usually the proximal humerus or the proximal tibia. And this is a big shift from maybe 20 years ago. Modern IO devices are robust. They can handle high flow infusions, often under pressure bags. And yes, crucially, they are certified for infusing blood products, packed cells, plasma, the works.
So the ideal is still two big peripheral IVs, but IO is a very solid, very fast plan B.
Exactly. It's often the most reliable access you can get quickly when peripheral veins have collapsed. Don't waste precious minutes fishing around while the patient's dying. Get the IO, start resuscitation.
And that need for rapid access often ties directly into activating the massive transfusion protocol, the MTP. What signs, what source details should make you think MTP immediately based on how the injury happened or how the patient looks?
Good question. Activating MTP isn't something you do lightly, but you also can't wait until they've lost half their blood volume. You activate based on predictors. Key signs from the sources include things like a systolic blood pressure that just won't stay above 90 mmHg despite initial fluids.
Okay.
Or a heart rate persistently over 120 beats per minute. Obvious signs of severe bleeding, like maybe a fast exam showing tons of fluid in the belly, or a massive hemothorax. But sometimes it's just the mechanism itself. a high-speed car crash with major deformity, a fall from a significant height, a large caliber gunshot wound to the chest or abdomen.
You just know it's going to be bad.
You anticipate it. You activate MTP preemptively. You get the blood bank moving before the patient is circling the drain. You're preparing for the worst, hoping for the best.
Beyond getting fluids and blood in, we also have to prevent making things worse on arrival.
Mm-hmm.
The patient usually comes in on a long board, but we absolutely have to stress keeping that cervical spine stabilized, right? See spine precautions.
It's non-negotiable. Absolutely non-negotiable until cleared by imaging, usually a CT scan. Chest trauma often involves massive forces, deceleration, impact. These can easily cause associated neck fractures.
Mm-hmm.
And even a seemingly small movement of the head or neck while you're assessing them, moving them, rolling them to check their back. It could shift an unstable fracture and sever or damage the spinal cord. Irreversible paralysis. So that rigid collar stays on, proper manual alignment is maintained by someone at the head of the bed until it's formally cleared, period.
Let's switch gears to penetrating wounds. There's that hard and fast rule about embedded objects.
The rule is simple and absolute. Never pull out a penetrating object in the field or the ED. Don't do it.
Why not? It seems counterintuitive, maybe.
Because that object, that knife, piece of metal, branch, whatever it is, it might be the only thing plugging a hole in a major blood vessel or the lung itself. It's acting as a tamponade.
Oh.
You pull it out and you might unleash massive, uncontrollable bleeding right there. You convert a contained injury into an immediate catastrophe. You stabilize the object securely so it doesn't move, pat around it, and wait for the trauma surgeon to remove it under controlled conditions in the operating room.
Got it. Okay, then there's the classic sucking chest wound and open pneumothorax. Sounds dramatic. And it really is an emergency needing a specific field maneuver. You cover it with a non-porous dressing, but only tape three sides. Explain that again, the physiology behind leaving one side open.
Yeah, this is a brilliant, simple, life-saving technique. Taping only three sides creates a makeshift one-way valve or a flutter valve.
Yeah.
If you take all four sides, you'd seal it completely airtight. Now, if the patient has an underlying lung injury leaking air, which they probably do, that air would enter the pleural space with each breath but have no way to get out. Pressure builds up rapidly.
And you've just created a tension pneumothorax.
Exactly. You turn a bad situation into a potentially fatal one.
Ooh.
By leaving that one side untaped, usually the bottom edge, when the patient breathes in, the negative pressure inside the chest sucks the dressing flat against the wound, sealing it and preventing outside air from getting in. But when they breathe out, the pressure inside the chest rises, pushes that untaped edge open slightly, and lets the trapped air escape out.
Ingenious. Let's air out, not in.
Precisely. It prevents that dangerous pressure buildup. A simple piece of plastic and some tape can literally buy critical time.
And through all this initial chaos, what's the absolute rock bottom minimum target for oxygen saturation we're aiming for?
We need to keep that SpO2 at 90% or higher. Hypoxia kills brain cells fast. We need at least that level to ensure basic oxygen delivery to vital organs, keep the heart and brain functioning while we figure out the underlying problem and get definitive treatment sorted.
Okay, so we've stabilized them initially anyway. Now comes the detective work, figuring out what actually got damaged and how. Let's compare the mechanics. Blunt versus penetrating trauma.
Right. So blunt trauma is caused by impact forces. Think car crashes, falls, crush injuries, even a hard hit in sports. And it's often the more insidious type.
Why insidious?
Because the outside might look okay, maybe just some bruising or tenderness, but the kinetic energy transfer goes deep. It can cause devastating internal injuries, ruptured aorta, bruised lungs, pulmonary contusions, torn spleen or liver. All without much external evidence initially, it's harder to spot.
Okay. And penetrating.
Penetrating is usually more obvious. You see the hole, right? Gunshot, stab wounds. But the danger here is predicting the path of the object and the internal damage. Especially with bullets, the cavitation effect creates a zone of destruction much larger than the bullet itself. But the key takeaway for both, that constant looming threat of massive internal bleeding, both types can kill quickly through hemorrhage.
So after that initial ABC check, the primary survey, what are the more subtle signs nurses need to be watching for during the secondary assessment? Beyond just obvious difficulty breathing, what specific findings should set off alarm bells?
Oh, you're listening carefully, right? Auscultation is key. Besides a cough, maybe with some blood, hemoptysis, or general shortness of breath, the big red flag is asymmetry in breath sounds.
Asymmetry. meaning different sounds side to side.
Exactly. If you hear decreased breath sounds, or worse, absent breath sounds on one side compared to the other, you have to immediately suspect a significant problem in the pleural space on that side. Either air, a pneumothorax, or blood, a hemothorax, is filling that space, pushing the lung away, collapsing it. That's a major finding.
And we also need to be constantly watching for signs. The whole system is starting to fail, right? Signs of shock, of decompensation.
Constantly. You're looking for those classic signs the body is trying and failing to compensate. Low blood pressure, hypotension, fast heart rate, tachycardia. That means the body's struggling to keep organs perfused, usually because of low blood volume, hypovolemia. But, and this is important, we need to start thinking about why they're in shock. Is it straightforward hemorrhagic shock they're bleeding out? Or is it something else, like the obstructive shock we'll talk about with tension, pneumothorax?
Good point. Let's discuss a specific physical finding that feels really weird. Subcutaneous emphysema. You mentioned crepitus, that Rice Krispies feeling under the skin. How reliable is that? And how worried should we be if we feel it?
Oh, crepitus is highly reliable. Once you feel it, you'll never forget it. It's unmistakable, that crackling, crunching feeling when you palpate the skin. It means air has escaped from the chest cavity, maybe from a tear in the lung or the airway, and it's tracked into the subcutaneous tissues under the skin.
Okay. Is a little bit normal, say, around a chest tube?
Yeah, a small amount right around a chest tube insertion site or after certain surgeries can be expected and often isn't a major concern. But if you find extensive crepitus, especially if it's spreading rapidly up the neck, maybe into the face, that's a very bad sign.
Why is that rapid spread so alarming?
Because it implies a large ongoing air leak that isn't being contained. And as that air tracks up into the neck and around the trachea, it can actually start to compress the airway from the outside.
Oh.
Yeah, it can cause airway obstruction. So rapidly expanding subcutaneous emphysema, especially in the neck, is an emergency. It might mean the patient needs intubation urgently, perhaps even a surgical airway, because the underlying air leak is significant and uncontrolled. It shifts you into immediate intervention mode.
Okay, moving to another really dangerous mechanical problem, flail chest. This happens when you have multiple ribs fractured in multiple places, creating a segment of the chest wall that's no longer stable.
Hmm.
What's the classic sign we look for?
The absolute hallmark clinical sign is paradoxical chest movement.
Paradoxical. Explain that.
Normally, when you inhale, your whole chest wall expands outwards. With a flail segment, that broken, unstable piece does the opposite. It gets sucked inward during inhalation while the rest of the chest moves out. Then, when you exhale, it gets pushed outward.
That sounds incredibly painful and inefficient.
It is. It's extremely painful, and more importantly, it makes breathing very ineffective. The lung underneath that flail segment can't expand properly. This leads quickly to hypoxia, fatigue, and often severe respiratory failure.
Patients with flail chest, they're always admitted to the ICU, right? And you mentioned managing the pain is tricky, needing strong pain relief but risking opioid side effects.
Yeah.
What's the mortality like, and how has management changed? Is it different now than, say, 20 years ago?
Flail chest definitely carries a high risk of complications and death, especially if there's also significant underlying lung bruising, pulmonary contusion. 20 years ago, the approach was often heavy sedation, maybe paralysis, and mechanical ventilation to essentially take over breathing.
Right. Let the ventilator do the work.
Exactly. But today, the thinking has shifted significantly. The focus is much more on aggressive, non-opioid pain control to allow the patient to breathe effectively on their own, if possible.
So what's the gold standard for that pain control now? This seems key for our learners.
The gold standard now involves regional anesthesia, specifically nerve blocks targeting the chest wall. Things like the serratus anterior plane block or paravertebral blocks are becoming much more common and are incredibly effective.
Why those blocks specifically? What's the advantage?
The huge advantage is they provide really dense targeted pain relief right where it's needed on the injured chest wall without the systemic side effects of opioids like sedation and respiratory depression.
Ah, okay. So they're awake, comfortable enough to breathe deeply.
Precisely. If the patient isn't in agony with every breath, they can cough effectively, clear secretions, use their incentive spirometer, participate in pulmonary toileting, all the things they need to do to prevent pneumonia and lung collapse without us having to sedate them so much that we risk needing to intubate them just because of the pain meds. So in flail chest, excellent pain management is excellent respiratory management. It's a critical link.
Okay, let's really zero in now on the space where a lot of these immediate problems happen, the pleural space. that potential space between the lung and the chest wall. Pretty much all the severe immediate issues involve something collecting in their air or fluid leading to lung collapse, and pneumothorax.
Right. And pneumothorax is collapsed lungs. They come in different flavors depending on how they started, don't they? They do. We generally bucket them into three main categories based on origin. First, you have spontaneous pneumothorax. This happens seemingly out of the blue, no trauma involved. Often it's due to a ruptured bleb, like a tiny blister on the lung surface.
Who gets those typically?
There's a classic demographic, tall, thin, young males, thought to be related to pressure changes in the chest cavity. Also, people with underlying lung disease like COPD or cystic fibrosis are at higher risk.
Okay. Then there are the ones caused by medical interventions.
Right, the iatrogenic pneumothoraxes. Unfortunately, these happen as a complication of necessary medical procedures. Things like accidentally nicking the lung during central line insertion, especially in the subclavian vein, or sometimes from positive pressure ventilation causing barotrauma, even occasionally during things like feeding tube placement or lung biopsies.
And the third type.
The third is traumatic pneumothorax, which is what we've mostly been discussing, directly caused by either blunt force injury or a penetrating wound to the chest.
Now, within traumatic pneumothorax, there's the one that's the true, immediate, life-threatening emergency, the tension pneumothorax. If a clinician misses this, the outcome can be catastrophic very quickly. We know it's trapped air building up pressure, but can you walk us through the detailed pathophysiology? How does that pressure actually kill the patient?
Yes, understanding this mechanism is absolutely vital for recognizing it clinically. In a tension pneumothorax, there's usually a flap-like injury to the lung or airway. Air gets into the pleural space with each breath, but the flap closes on exhalation so the air can't get back out. It's a one-way valve into the chest.
Trapping air.
Trapping air under increasing pressure. This pressure rapidly exceeds the normal atmospheric pressure. It completely collapses the lung on the injured side, obviously. But then it does something even worse. That massive pressure starts pushing the entire central structure of the chest, the heart, the trachea, the great vessels, the mediastinum, over towards the uninjured side.
That's the mediastinal shift we hear about.
That's the mediastinal shift. And this shift causes two critical problems simultaneously. First, yes, it compresses the good lung, making it harder to breathe. But the primary reason a tension pneumothorax causes rapid cardiovascular collapse is that the shift physically kinks or compresses the great veins returning blood to the heart, the superior and inferior vena cava.
So the heart itself might be fine, but it's not getting any blood back to pump.
Exactly. Venous return drops to almost nothing. If there's no blood coming back to the heart, no preload, then the heart has nothing to pump out, no cardiac output.
So the blood pressure plummets.
Plummets precipitously. A patient goes into shock very quickly. But it's not shock from bleeding, it's obstructive shock. The pump is fine, but the plumbing leading back to it is blocked by the pressure. That's the key distinction.
And the signs. We always hear about tracheal deviation.
Tracheal deviation, where you can literally see or feel the windpipe push off to one side, is a classic sign, yes, but it's often a late sign, sometimes preterminal. The earlier signs are profound respiratory distress, rapidly falling blood pressure, distended neck veins, jugular venous distension or JVD, because the blood can't get back into the chest, maybe muffled heart sounds and cyanosis. If you suspect tension pneumothorax based on those signs, you don't wait for an x-ray. You decompress immediately. Needle decompression first, followed by a chest tube.
That distinction between hemorrhagic shock and obstructive shock from tension, that seems absolutely critical for everyone listening to grasp. Okay, beyond air, that pleural space can also fill up with fluid. Let's quickly differentiate the main types.
Right. The most common fluid we see in trauma is blood leading to a hemothorax. This is obviously a big problem because it signifies ongoing bleeding inside the chest. The source could be torn blood vessels in the chest wall, the lung itself, or even major vessels. We treat this with chest tubes, usually large ones placed low down in the chest because blood pools with gravity.
Is there a point where the amount of blood coming out tells you it's really bad, like needing surgery, bad?
Yes, there are clinical thresholds for defining a massive hemothorax, which usually indicates a need for urgent surgery, the thoracotomy, to find and stop the bleeding source. Typically, that's defined as getting more than 1,500 milliliters of blood out immediately when the chest tube goes in, or continued bleeding of more than 200 milliliters per hour for about 2 to 4 consecutive hours. If you hit those numbers, the surgeon needs to be notified immediately because conservative management is likely failing.
Okay. And what about other types of fluid? There's one more main one, usually not related to trauma.
That would be chylothorax. This is when lymphatic fluid, called chyle, accumulates in the pleural space. Chyle is kind of milky looking. It usually happens if the main lymphatic vessel in the chest, the thoracic duct, is damaged or blocked. This is often associated with cancers or sometimes complications from certain types of chest or esophageal surgery. Occasionally, very severe crush injuries can cause it too. Managing chylothorax is quite different, often involves special low-fat diets or surgical procedures to tie off the leaking duct. It's not the same immediate emergency response as for air or blood in trauma.
So when simpler measures like chest tubes aren't enough, or if the injury is just too severe from the get-go, like that massive hemothorax needing direct control of bleeding, we have to move to open surgery. Let's talk about the main surgical approaches to the chest.
Okay. The most common major open approach for trauma or complex lung issues is the thoracotomy. This involves making an incision between the ribs to gain wide access to the chest cavity. Surgeons use this for major lung resections, repairing trauma, controlling massive bleeding. It gives them the direct view and access they need.
And that's different from what they do for heart surgery.
Yes. For most heart surgeries, the standard approach is a median sternotomy. That's where they actually split the breastbone, the sternum, right down the middle. This gives excellent access to the heart and the major blood vessels right behind it, like the aorta. You typically wouldn't use this approach just for a lung problem unless it was somehow related to the central structures.
Are there less invasive options becoming more common?
Definitely. VATS, which stands for video-assisted thoracoscopic surgery, has revolutionized things. This uses small incisions, maybe just a few keyholes, and a tiny camera, a thoracoscope, along with specialized long instruments.
What's VATS good for?
It's great for many things. Diagnosing problems, taking lung biopsies, treating recurrent spontaneous pneumothoraces, sometimes even smaller lung cancer resections or draining complex fluid collections. The big advantages are much less post-operative pain, shorter hospital stays, and faster recovery compared to a big open thoracotomy.
Depending on the reason for surgery cancer, severe trauma, sometimes part or all of the lung needs to come out. What are the terms for those resections?
If they remove just one section, one lobe of the lung, remember the right lung has three lobes, the left has two, that's called a lobectomy. This is very common for localized lung cancer or trauma confined to one area.
Okay.
If the entire lung needs to be removed, that's a pneumonectomy. This is obviously a much bigger operation reserved for really extensive disease or massive trauma destroying the whole lung. Life after a pneumonectomy requires significant adaptation as the remaining lung has to take over all the work of gas exchange.
Post-operative nursing care after any of these major chest surgeries must be intense, right? Focused on preventing lung complications. What are the absolute must-do components, especially thinking back to that pain management issue?
Absolutely intense. And yes, pain management is still front and center. It has to be aggressive enough for the patient to take deep breaths and cough, but we have to be incredibly vigilant. Continuous pulse oximetry is standard. Watching that respiratory rate and depth like a hawk, monitoring for opioid-induced respiratory depression is non-negotiable.
So aiming for zero pain isn't realistic, but managing it so they can function is key.
Exactly. A pain score of 0 out of 10 after a thoracotomy, not likely. But if their breathing slows down too much, if their oxygen saturation starts dropping, we have to immediately rethink the pain strategy. Maybe switch agents. Consider regional techniques, if not already done, involve the pain team.
Beyond just meds, the cornerstone of preventing post-op lung problems is what's often called pulmonary toileting.
Yeah.
Can you define that concept for our listeners?
Pulmonary toileting is basically the combination of all the active things we do and get the patient to do to keep their lungs clear and expanded after surgery. The goal is to prevent secretions from building up, prevent the small air sacs, alveoli, from collapsing, which is called atelectasis, and ultimately prevent pneumonia. It's absolutely critical to avoid getting stuck in that cycle of shallow breathing, retained secretions, and infection.
So what specific techniques fall under this umbrella? What should nurses be consistently encouraging or enforcing?
Number one, far and away, mobilization. Getting the patient out of bed and into a chair, even for short periods, as soon as safely possible, even with drains and lines, makes a huge difference in lung expansion and clearing secretions. Then, the breathing exercises. Teaching and enforcing deep breathing and coughing exercises regularly. Splinting the incision with a pillow can help make coughing less painful. Frequent repositioning in bed is also important.
And the classic bedside tool.
The incentive spirometer, or IS. That little plastic device they have to suck on to make the ball or piston rise. We usually aim for 10 good, slow, deep breaths using the IS every hour while they're awake. It gives them visual feedback and really encourages those deep breaths needed to pop open collapsed alveoli at the lung bases.
What about things to help actually loosen and clear the mucus, the phlegm?
Yeah, sometimes deep breathing and coughing isn't enough, especially if secretions are thick. That's where airway clearance devices come in, often guided by respiratory therapists. Things like the flutter valve, a cappella, or cornet devices use positive expiratory pressure, PEP, and oscillation during exhalation. That vibration helps shake mucus loose from the airway walls, making it easier to cough out. Aggressive, consistent pulmonary toileting mobilizing, deep breathing, IS, coughing. Maybe PE therapy is probably the single most important factor in ensuring a smooth recovery after chest surgery.
We keep coming back to the chest tube. It's the workhorse for managing many of these pleural space problems. Let's just clearly state again, what are the three main goals of putting in a chest tube?
Sure. The three fundamental goals are, one, physically remove whatever shouldn't be there, air in the case of a pneumothorax, or fluid like blood or pus in a hemothorax or empyema. Two, by removing that stuff, you restore the normal negative pressure within the pleural space, which is essential for the lung to expand properly. And three, facilitate the full re-expansion of the collapsed lung tissue itself.
And we touched on placement. It follows basic physics, right? High for air, low for fluid.
Exactly. Air rises, so if the primary problem is a pneumothorax, the tube usually goes higher up, often the second or third intercostal space in the front or mid-axillary line. These might be smaller tubes, like pigtail catheters sometimes. Fluid, on the other hand, sinks due to gravity. So for draining blood, hemothorax, or thick pus, empyema, the tube needs to be placed lower down and often further back, maybe the eighth or ninth intercostal space laterally or posteriorly. And these tubes are typically larger bore to handle thicker drainage.
Okay, let's talk about the drainage system itself. That box connected to the tube that usually hangs off the bed or is attached to wall suction. There are two main types of suction control we need to understand.
Right, we need to differentiate between wet suction and dry suction systems. The traditional ones are wet suction. These use a column of water in a specific chamber to actually regulate the amount of suction applied to the patient's chest.
So the bubbling in that chamber sets the pressure?
Yes. The level of water in the suction control chamber dictates the pressure, typically set around negative 20 centimeters of water pressure. If you're using a wet system, you must ensure the wall suction source is turned on high enough, usually a minimum of 80 millimolar HG, to create gentle bubbling in that chamber. The bubbling confirms the suction is working, but the water level sets the actual therapeutic pressure. These are often used for draining fluid or blood.
Okay, and the other type?
The newer and increasingly common type is dry suction. These systems use an internal regulator mechanism, usually a dial, to set the desired suction pressure. Again, typically around negative 20 centimeter H2O.
So no water needed for the suction part?
Correct. No water in the suction control chamber itself. You just dial in the pressure. It's generally considered a bit quieter and perhaps easier to set up accurately. You still need to connect it to wall suction and turn the wall suction on, but the machine regulates the pressure internally. Dry systems are very commonly used for managing air leaks.
Now let's really focus on the part of the system nurses interact with constantly, the water seal chamber. This seems like the diagnostic window into the patient's chest.
It absolutely is. Mastering interpretation of the water seal chamber is a crucial nursing skill. It serves two main functions. One, it acts as a one-way valve, preventing atmospheric air from going back into the chest through the tube. And two, it provides vital information about what's happening in the pleural space, specifically regarding air leaks and lung expansion.
Okay, let's break down what we should see. What is titling and why is seeing it usually a good sign?
Titling is that normal, gentle rising and falling of the water level in the water seal chamber that happens in sync with the patient's breathing. When the patient inhales, the negative pressure in their chest increases slightly, pulling the water level up. When they exhale, the pressure decreases and the water level falls.
So it reflects the pressure changes.
Exactly. Seeing titling confirms two things. One, the chest tube is patent, not kinked or blocked. And two, it's correctly placed within the pleural space and reflecting those normal respiratory pressure fluctuations. It generally means the system is working as intended.
What if you don't see titling? When titling is absent.
Absent titling is a red flag that needs investigation. It can mean one of two main things. Either the lung has fully re-expanded and filled the pleural space, so there are no pressure changes to reflect anymore, which is good. Or the tube is somehow obstructed. Maybe it's kinked in the bedding, or there's a clot inside it, or it's pulled out slightly. An obstruction is obviously bad as it prevents drainage and could lead to problems like tension pneumothorax if there's still an air leak. So absent titling needs troubleshooting immediately.
And what about bubbling in that water seal chamber? What does that signify?
Bubbling in the water seal chamber indicates an air leak. Air is escaping from the patient's lung, or possibly the system, and bubbling through that water seal. We need to assess the pattern of bubbling.
Okay, patterns.
Yes. Intermittent bubbling, meaning it only happens when the patient coughs, exhales forcefully, or sometimes just with normal exhalation, usually indicates a persistent but likely manageable air leak from the lung itself. This is common after lung surgery or trauma and typically resolves as the lung heals.
And the other pattern?
Continuous bubbling that occurs throughout both inhalation and exhalation is more concerning. It suggests either a very large air leak from the patient's lung or, and this is critical to check, a leak somewhere in the chest drainage system itself, like a loose connection between the tube and the drainage unit, or maybe a crack in the tubing or the unit.
So you have to find the source.
Quickly, you start clamping momentarily near the patient insertion site and work your way down the tubing towards the unit. If the bubbling stops when you clamp near the chest, the leak is likely from the patient. If it continues, the leak is somewhere in the tubing or the system below your clamp. Finding and fixing system leaks is crucial because they prevent the system from maintaining negative pressure and helping the lung heal.
Monitoring the drainage output itself, the amount and color, is a huge nursing responsibility. When does the drainage change from, okay, this is expected, to, uh-oh, call the surgeon now?
You have to be meticulous about marking the drainage level, recording the amount, and noting the character, bloody, serious, pus-like, every shift, sometimes more often initially. The big emergency trigger is usually related to blood loss. Any sudden gush of bright red blood, or if the bloody drainage suddenly increases significantly, especially if it exceeds those thresholds we mentioned for massive hemothorax, like more than 200 milliliters per hour for several consecutive hours, that requires immediate notification of the provider.
Because it means active, uncontrolled bleeding.
Exactly. It suggests ongoing hemorrhage that isn't stopping, and the patient likely needs to go back to the operating room urgently to find and fix the source. Don't wait. Don't hesitate. Significant ongoing bloody output is a surgical emergency.
Finally, let's cover the never events or critical rules regarding chest tubes. What about clamping? When is it okay? When is it absolutely not okay? And what if the tube accidentally comes out?
Okay, rule number one, never routinely clamp a chest tube, especially if you suspect the patient still has an air leak. Clamping the tube traps any air leaking from the lung inside the chest, which can rapidly convert a simple pneumothorax into a life-threatening tension pneumothorax.
So when is clamping done?
Clamping should only be done very briefly and for specific reasons. Maybe momentarily to help locate an air leak in the system, as we just discussed, or sometimes very briefly when changing out the entire drainage unit. But never for transport, never just because. Never for routine monitoring. Avoid clamping unless specifically ordered or for those brief diagnostic moments.
And if the tube gets pulled out accidentally, it happens. What's the immediate action?
Yeah, it's scary when it happens for everyone involved. If a chest tube is accidentally dislodged from the patient's chest, the immediate first step is to cover the insertion site immediately with something occlusive. Sterile petroleum gauze, like Vaseline gauze, is ideal if available, but even a gloved hand will do initially. Then secure that dressing on three sides only, just like we talked about for the sucking chest wound.
Creating that flutter valve again.
Exactly. You want to prevent outside air from rushing into the chest, but allow any internal air pressure to escape. So, cover immediately, take three sides, assess the patient's respiratory status continuously, call for help urgently, and notify the provider.
The role of the nurse in educating the patient and their family throughout this whole chest tube experience seems enormous. It must be incredibly anxiety-provoking for them.
Oh, absolutely. Having a tube sticking out of your chest connected to a bubbling box, it's inherently frightening. Patients are often in pain, scared, unsure what's happening. Taking the time to clearly explain in simple terms why the tube is there to help their lung heal, what the noises mean, bubbling might be normal for a while, what they need to do, deep breathe, use the IS, mobilize, and reassuring them that it's temporary. That education and reassurance is a massive part of holistic nursing care. It reduces anxiety, improves cooperation, and ultimately aids recovery. Hashtag outro.
Wow, we covered a huge amount of really critical life-saving information today. If we were to boil it down, maybe just for a quick recap, some key takeaways for practice might be, always think about getting that IO access early if peripherals are tough. Remember that crepitus, the Rice Krispies, can signal a serious air leak, and definitely push for those non-opioid pain strategies like nerve blocks, especially in flail chest.
Yeah, those are great points. And I'd add, maybe most critically, really internalize the mechanism of tension pneumothorax, understanding that it causes obstructive shock by kinking the vena cava, not just collapsing the lung, explains why it's such an immediate killer and why decompression is so urgent. Mastering all these steps from that initial ABC assessment, recognizing subtle signs, managing complex injuries, right down to interpreting the nuances of the water seal chamber on a chest tube that really builds the foundation you need to be effective and confident in high-pressure emergency and critical care settings.
It definitely changes how you approach those first crucial minutes in the trauma bay, doesn't it?
It really does. So maybe we can leave you, our listeners, with a final thought to mull over, something that builds on what we discussed today. We talked about the thresholds for massive hemothorax, that initial 1,500 milliliter drain, or ongoing loss of 200 milliliter per hour for about 3 hours, usually indicating a need to go back to the OR.
Right.
So the question is, how does knowing those specific quantitative thresholds change the way you approach managing fluid resuscitation and, more importantly, blood product replacement in those initial hours after the chest tube goes in? Are you already thinking about preparing for surgery based on the rate of loss you're seeing per hour rather than just waiting for a huge total volume to accumulate? How does that rate influence your anticipation and preparation?
That's a really practical, forward-thinking question. Definitely something to keep top of mind during patient handovers and ongoing assessments. Excellent food for thought. We'll catch you next time for another deep dive.